from KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. Today is Ed Roberts Day in California, named for the late pioneering disability rights advocate who co-founded Berkeley's Center for Independent Living. Paralyzed from the neck down, he was the first severely disabled person to attend UC Berkeley. Here he is on 60 Minutes.
There are very few people, even with the most severe disabilities, who can't take control of their own life. The problem is that people around us don't expect us to.
Coming up on Forum, we discuss Roberts' life and legacy and talk about the state of the disabled rights movement in California. That's coming up next, after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Today is a state holiday honoring the birth of the late disability activist Ed Roberts. Ed Roberts, who was paralyzed from the neck down after contracting polio as a child, was the first severely disabled person to attend UC Berkeley. He also co-founded Berkeley's Center for Independent Living, which this evening will honor individuals who have made outstanding contributions to the disability rights movement. And we'll check in with three of the honorees as we discuss his legacy and the state of disability rights today. First, we want to talk with Lowell Bergman, old friend of the Forum program, professor of investigating reporting at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism, who back in the 80s did a piece for 60 Minutes. He produced it. Harry Reasoner interviewed Ed Roberts and focused on Ed Roberts. And Lowell Bergman, welcome to Forum. Good morning.
Nice to be here, Michael.
Glad to have you. Tell us why, in your judgment, it's important to honor this man this day.
Ed Roberts is a seminal figure, I think, in the history of America, recognizing the needs of its people. And we were lucky enough here in Berkeley to have him here, and that CIL, that is the Center for Independent Living, started here. My understanding is that there are hundreds of them now across the United States and the world. And he started all of this, and he convinced me that, in fact, people with very severe disabilities can do just about anything.
Yeah, his story is really an inspiring one, and I'd like our listeners to hear a clip from the show that you produced on 60 Minutes back in 1989. Here's Ed Roberts.
There are very few people, even with the most severe disabilities, who can't take control of their own life. The problem is that people around us don't expect us to. We built a system, a political system, a system of public policy based on old attitudes that actually allow us off the hook, that have no expectations, that believe that we will not work or participate in our communities. But in fact, we've discovered that the reality is just the opposite.
Now, at that time, Lowell, this was really pretty innovative and new, wasn't it? That kind of insight?
It was innovative, it was new, and as I learned quickly when I met him, it contradicted a story I did previously and changed my opinion of basically everything related to the cost of keeping people alive. I think Ed was an advocate of the right to life for everyone and put it in a way that those of us who might think that it costs too much, too many machines, too many people, too many attendants to pay for, that those people can actually lead us in many directions we'd never thought of before.
Well, he was certainly a leader and a pioneer. And you, let's get back to the 60 Minutes show that you produced. You had him in an iron lung at the time, which later he changed. But that was
No. He was out of the iron lung a lot in those days. The problem with him that he confronted us with for doing a piece was, how do you interview somebody who every 20 seconds, for instance, has to gasp for air, and how do you edit it? And so the only way we could figure out at least doing most of the interview was to have him back in the iron lung, and we had to shoot it through a mirror, basically, while he was lying down. You can hear in the piece the pump in the iron lung going, but we could edit around that sound.
But he still had to sleep in the iron lung, and for quite a bit of time, I believe he was in an iron lung, until he decided to go out in a wheelchair, and then you had him moving along in a wheelchair at about, 25 miles an hour in some instances?
Right, he would zoom down the street with flags flying, and we put cameras on his feet, and he went on BART and so on. So you can see the piece on YouTube.
Yeah, it is on YouTube. And can you tell us a little bit about the Rolling Quads? There may be people in Berkeley who remember that.
Well, as one of the people you're going to interview, his mother can recount, Ed became one of the first severely disabled people to ever register at the university and definitely to graduate, also with a master's degree. He broke in the University of California to the severely disabled. And when he applied, they didn't reveal that. So when he showed up, there were no facilities, there were no ramps, there were none of the things we take for granted today available. But his experience in getting the university to accept him resulted in more people applying, more people getting in, and they formed a group called the Rolling Quads, which did, amongst other things, break the airlines in the United States into taking severely disabled people on their aircraft.
Talking with Lowell Bergman, he's professor of investigative reporting at UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. I'm going to take your tip here and talk to Ed Roberts' mother. And Lowell, thank you for joining us. Appreciate your being
nice
with
to
us.
Be here, Michael. Thank you. Bye.
Zona Roberts is the mother of Ed Roberts, and she joins us by phone. And Zona Roberts, welcome to the program. Glad to have you.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And your son, just to back up for a moment, was really one of the last victims of polio before the vaccine. He was paralyzed at about age 19?
No, 14. He was 14.
14, okay.
And had been an athlete, so it was a big shock to him, to say nothing of our family.
Yeah, and for a while he was suicidal. I mean, he didn't see really much purpose in living and decided, to starve himself to death?
Yeah. He had trouble eating, and it was something that was kind of being forced on him. There was a nurse who kept insisting that he have all these milkshakes and things because he didn't weigh 90-something pounds. Excuse me. So it was easy for him not to eat. So as he said, he saw no point in living at that point. What was he going to do? Did you just have to lie there and be a lump? He didn't like that part of the world very much. He liked to do things. He'd been a very active young man, playing lots of sports and with his younger brothers into all kinds of mischief.
What changed in his mind? I mean, what turned him to away from suicide?
Well, parents I knew at the co-op nursery school I was in was a psychiatrist, and I talked to him, and he went and talked to Ed, and he talked to the nurse around him, and he said, take that nurse off of there and see what happens. And when Ed had the power, whether he ate or not, just to himself, he decided he wanted to eat. And from then on, he ate. And the older he got, the more he loved eating. And supervising food and stuff. He got to be a real foodie.
He also had a love for, which he talks about in 60 Minutes, a natural function. He loved sex and wound up actually getting married and having a child, getting divorced.
And having a son and a divorce, yes. Yes, he said, Mom, I'm right in the middle of the mainstream here in this life. Yes, he, from being told when he was... were applying when he was going to College of San Mateo, which he did right after Burlingame High School. He applied to UC, and we applied to, because we couldn't afford to send him. And he applied, and he was accepted on his academic merits, and that was something that the department was not going to pay for, because they said to him and to us, you can't have, whatever would you do? We can't afford to put money into you because you wouldn't be doing anything. I love that story because guess what? 9 years later, Ed was appointed by Jerry Brown to be director of rehab for the state of California. I just love that story.
Yeah, I bet you do, and I can understand why you do. It's quite a story. Yes. And a remarkable story in so many ways. Now when we almost take for granted all the ramps and the disabled, what's available to people who have disabilities. I mean, I guess early on they didn't even think your son could get in the dormitory at Berkeley, did they?
Oh, that's right. Well, you couldn't. When we arrived at campus – it was a startled constituency around here who saw him. But they sent us to Cowell Hospital, which was the hospital on campus at that time. It no longer exists, to see Henry Bruin, who was the medical director of Cowell Hospital. And I think what they expected was for Henry to tell us to, oh, no, they're just, you know, we don't have anything for you. But that wasn't Henry. He looked at Ed and he said, you young people who were in the polio epidemic need a chance to be educated. You need to go to school. You need to go to college. I'll see what I can do. And Henry Bruin opened the doors of UC. Maybe many years later, some of the UC people thought that was a big mistake. But at that time, Henry Bruin did. We loved him.
Now, Henry Bruin was a hero. And so was your son,
yes,
may I add. And
yes.
Congratulations on this being Ed Roberts Day in the state of California.
Yes, what a shock, too. I think it's wonderful. I'm purring in this admiration. Thank you.
I love hearing you purr. Thank you so much for joining us. That's Sona Roberts, who's the mother of Ed Roberts. Again, today is Ed Roberts Day. Let me tell you who else is joining us for this hour. Thomas Gregory is deputy director of the Center for Independent Living, which would have never been had it not been for Ed Roberts. Thomas Gregory, good to have you with us on Forum. Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
And Raymond Lifschitz also joins us. Raymond Lifschitz is professor of architecture, city and regional planning for UC Berkeley, and we welcome you to the program as well.
Thank you.
And we will be talking with a number of other people in the course of this hour. And, of course, we do want to hear from you, our listeners, in the course of the hour as well, particularly some of you who have continuing ongoing concerns about disabilities. And that's what I want to get into with you, Thomas Gregory. First of all, there are ongoing battles, and I just wanted to make that clear to listeners. We've come a long way since Ed Roberts, to put it mildly, but the battles go on. There's civil rights bills that are waiting, and there's things that are being legislated and so forth. What do you see as the major battles now?
I think perhaps the biggest battle is what Ed mentioned in the little clip you opened the show with. I believe his words were that there's very few people with disabilities who are not able to take control of their lives. The problem is that the people around us don't expect us to. And I think those low expectations remain. Attitudinal barriers can't really be legislated away. I know the ADA's stated purpose was, in addition to removing architectural barriers, they also wanted to change attitudes and eliminate discrimination. And over time, a statute can help with that, but it takes decades for hearts and minds to change. So those low expectations remain today, and we need more people like Ed Roberts who set an example by not letting those low expectations stop them, by not internalizing those low expectations, and by achieving great things despite what people expect is possible.
Well,
they
it's,
show us what, yes.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to say it's certainly understandable that you can talk about attitudes and put that at the top of the pantheon of needs here. But I'm also wondering about things that can be legislated. I mean, there's Assembly Bill 1335 and there's a Senate Bill 354. A lot of these have to do with transportation, housing, services and supports. And there's a lot on the table here and a lot that's moving through the legislature.
That's absolutely true. Now, the ADA was a giant stride, but it didn't even theoretically remove all barriers. Right now, the federal government is considering legislation, a bill called H.R. 620, that we feel would be a step backwards. It would make it more difficult for Americans to vindicate their rights under the ADA. And so we're concerned about that. Also, a lot of the architectural accessibility that was created by the ADA didn't apply to older buildings that were sort of grandfathered in. And so there remains a lot of buildings, public as well as private, that are difficult or even impossible in some cases for people with disabilities to access. You mentioned housing. Housing has to be both accessible and affordable in order to be useful for people with disabilities. People with disabilities statistically are among the poorest of the poor, and many of them rely on subsidized housing in order to remain housed. So the stock of subsidized housing, I'm talking about Section 8 vouchers and Project Best vouchers, especially in urban areas like the East Bay and San Francisco, there is a severe shortage of subsidized housing. And within that stock of subsidized housing, not all of the units by any means are accessible. So architectural accessibility remains a serious obstacle to the disability community. And yes, you are correct. There still are problems that can be solved through legislation.
Well, since you mentioned architecture, I want to welcome Raymond Lifschitz into this discussion. He's professor of architecture and city and regional planning at UC Berkeley and a recipient of one of the three awards that's being given tonight in honor of Ed Roberts and in honor also of these three recipients. And Raymond Lifschitz, first of all, let me welcome you and congratulate you on the award you're receiving.
Thank you.
And the award is well-deserved because you had a lot to do with architecture. Tell us your story. I mean, it begins at Columbia University?
Well, my story is too long to talk about now. I would like to start by talking about Berkeley and the College of Art and the Department of Architecture, which made all of this possible for me to take part. Architecture has been on this campus since its origins, and in the 60s, a new college was founded called the College of Environmental Design, and architecture was one of four departments with city and regional planning and landscape architecture and design. And the mantra of this new college, of the Department of Architecture, of the founders, was, in fact, that architecture is a social art. And this was a defined break from the historic connection to architecture as a fine art, which comes from France and the Beaux-Arts. When I arrived in 70, I was so fortunate to be hired. I came as a graduate student, and I was so fortunate to be hired to teach undergraduates and to teach undergraduates design, because I had felt all the way from college and teaching at Columbia before coming that architect, how does one actually initiate the concept of architecture as a social art in teaching? One thing led to another. My practice in New York City introduced me to people in wheelchairs because of a project, the Manhattan State Hospital project in New York City. And when I got to Berkeley, I discovered the town was filled with young people who were very much like those I had met in state hospitals as an architect. And in the hospitals, they told me they had no place to go because of the disability. And in Berkeley, there they were. I began to chat, take notes. I had a wonderful graduate student named Barbara Winslow who joined me in the effort. And we produced the book, Design for Independent Living. But in the years from the beginning, long until the 80s and early 80s, I decided that my undergraduates who worked in studio with me 3 days a week, as many as 105, 110 in one studio for 3 hours a week, and with the help of graduate students, I decided that they should work as in teams so that they would become more more knowledgeable, that their own work would be conditioned by their neighbors, who their neighbors were. So they worked in teams, each having his own or her building, but the buildings had neighbors. And
but let me just define, if I could, excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt you, but no. I want to just make listeners aware of the fact what you were working on, and you became one of the first proponents of this, was a universal design that could be used by those in wheelchairs or anybody else for that matter, right?
Well, that term really comes later. But I think the central connection to Berkeley and Ed Roberts was that I asked my students, design students, to always have clients, one of whom at least had a disability. And then to introduce them, I began to bring young disabled people in town to talk to the students about their work, to look at the designs and say, yes, I could get into that. No, I could not. And that's what led to the book. And it led to recognition by the barrier-free environment and the film and so on. So
The title of the book?
The first one is Design for Independent Living. It's been republished by University of California Press. And the second book is Rethinking Architecture, which is one that it's an edited book that I did with disabled people who worked on the projects. But I just want to emphasize that none of this would have been possible without my colleagues who thought that this was an important part of what how to teach architecture as a social art. Richard Bender, for example, my dean, could not have been more supportive. And they continued to give me students, and students did really well.
Well, I congratulate you again on being a recipient. And there are three recipients of this award. We spoke with Zona Roberts, who is the mother of Ed Roberts, and Rabin Lifshitz, professor of architecture and city and regional planning at UC Berkeley, is the second of those three recipients. And I want to get Corey Lee in here, who's a travel writer. He's the third recipient. He focuses on traveling in a wheelchair. Corey Lee, welcome to the program, and congratulations to you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate your being with us. And you've done a lot in terms of making things more transportable. And I'd like to hear essentially what you've done so people know what you've contributed here.
Yeah. Well, about 4 years ago, I started Curb Free with CoreyLee.com, which is a travel blog that's devoted to wheelchair accessible travel. And I really started that then because there really wasn't a lot of information online about accessibility when it came to traveling. And I wanted to just share like my experiences as I traveled the world to hopefully inspire others to do the same. And so since then, the blog has grown and it's gained a little over 50,000 followers now and became the world's number one blog devoted to accessible travel. I'm really excited about that, and it's truly an honor to receive the Ed Roberts Award tonight.
Yeah, well, it's an honor to have you here, and I want to mention I learned from your blog that South Africa and North Europe are totally wheelchair accessible in terms of traveling potentials for people who have disabilities. And what I'd like to do at this point is invite our listeners to join us. Obviously, we'd like to hear from some of you who have disabilities about the whole history that we've kind of compressed into this hour, using Ed Roberts Day as the catalyst, but also hearing your thoughts about living with disabilities. And certainly this is not necessarily limited to people with disabilities, people who live with people with disabilities or love people with disabilities. We want to hear your thoughts and where you would like to go and where you would like, in fact, the disability movement to go. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, so feel free to join us. Again, you can do that now at 866-733-6786. Also, you can join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Any questions or comments you have can be posted there. And you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our focus is on disability rights. This is Ed Roberts Day, and we are commemorating and honoring the memory of Ed Roberts, who was a pioneer in disability activism, and you are certainly welcome to join the program. In fact, we would indeed like to hear from you if you have some thoughts about disability rights or people who have done work for the disability community that you think deserve being mentioned and recognized. And since it's Ed Roberts Day, we spoke with Lowell Bergman before, who produced a program on Ed Roberts and disability for 60 Minutes. And here's another clip of that program on 60 Minutes, Harry Reasoner interviewing Ed Roberts.
Ed Roberts says that at the university, he learned a lot in and out of class.
I fell in love. It, like many people do, we do that as well. And it became ridiculously inconvenient to have my attendant pushing me around in my wheelchair with my girlfriend. It was an extra person that I didn't need to be more intimate. I learned how to drive a power wheelchair in one day. I was so motivated to learn something that it changed in many ways my perception of my disability and of myself. She jumped on my lap and we rode off into the sunset or to the closest motel.
That was Ed Roberts again speaking on 60 Minutes, and there are some highlights in that. You can see it on YouTube, as Lo Bergman said. He would push with two fingers because he had some movement in those two fingers and go down Hearst Street and places like that in the UC Berkeley campus at quite a clip. But we have Thomas Gregory with us, who's deputy director of the Center for Independent Living, which really was inspired by Ed Roberts, and Raymond Lifshitz, who's professor of architecture and city and regional planning at UC Berkeley. Zona Roberts, Ed Roberts' mother, and Corey Lee, a travel writer who focuses on traveling in a wheelchair. Earlier, we heard from Lo Bergman, and Corey Lee and Zona Roberts and Raymond Lifshitz are all being honored this evening. And I want to get to your calls, but Thomas Gregory, let me just find out from you what you do at the Center for Independent Living and what you carry on in terms of, well, this legacy we're talking about with Ed Roberts.
Well, we have some core services that we must perform in order to maintain our designation as an independent living center. Those include information and referral, systems change advocacy, independent living skills training, and peer counseling, as well as helping people transition from high school to post-secondary life, education, or employment. And we also try to help people who are institutionalized get out of institutions and help people who are at risk of being institutionalized access the home and community-based services they need in order to remove the risk of needing to enter an institution in order to get the supports they need.
And there are how many of these centers for independent living now? Yours was the first. How many are there roughly?
Yes, there's over 350 across the nation. They're all except for our center, they're created by the Rehab Act, the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, as amended by the Workforce Innovations and Opportunities Act of 2014. Theoretically, the entire nation is carved up into catchments, and wherever you are, there should be an independent living center that's responsible for serving you. I should say that there's some really large catchments where it's not really realistic for the center to serve everyone in a large, often rural area. But theoretically, the nation's covered.
Well, let me cover some calls here. Lots of people want to join us in this hour. And let's start, Dan, with you. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. How you doing? I want to push back a little bit on barriers issues as it pertains to federal and even state laws. The fact of the matter is that if you followed all the federal laws in San Francisco, you'd have to tear down most of Chinatown, large sections of North Beach, Noe Valley, the Mission, and any kind of access for small business. And lawyers have attacked small businesses for having steps. These steps that lead into their businesses are not their fault. They're not the fault of the owners. I am all for, in new construction and even in renovation and remodeling, where it is possible in buildings, to put ramps and all kinds of access equipment in the buildings to make for independent access, but I am not for destroying the character of my city, and I am not for destroying, and in point of fact, when you try to do some of the stuff, even with remodeling, planning departments, San Francisco planning departments will oppose you. They opposed it in a building I was in 10 years ago, and they forced, when I wanted to put a ramp in there, they forced me to put two steps back in. And this was in conflict with federal law and even in state law. So what we really need to do is have a rational approach to access. New construction, absolutely. Remodeling where it doesn't structurally affect the buildings in terms of their integrity in earthquakes and what have you. We live in an earthquake zone. That's cool. But don't go after small businesses and don't allow lawyers to do that and sue them and destroy small businesses for access in buildings that were built in the 19th century and the early 20th century.
All right, Dan, I appreciate your call. And we don't have anybody from the Planning Commission, unfortunately. I'd like to hear what they'd have to say on this. But Raymond Lifshitz, is one of the pioneers in terms of architecture. And I've heard these complaints before by small business people. What do you say, Professor Lifshitz, to that?
Well, it's a problem. I have property in Oakland that I help manage, and we're continuously confronted by the issue of bringing property, making sure that property meets standards. And actually, in the long run, it's never a problem because we've never had to sell anything that didn't work. I don't know what the alternatives are. It's really, really out of my range of experience or even knowledge to. But I think the caller is correct. It's that people on the Planning Commission, wherever, who are not adequately sympathetic and knowledgeable.
It's a vexing problem. And I wonder, yeah. Thomas Gregory, you want to weigh in here?
Yes. So I know the ADA, and California actually has protections that go above and beyond the ADA. There was quite a negotiation and compromise to make sure that the competing interests of citizens and consumers with disabilities were considered alongside the interests of business owners and landlords who would shoulder the expense and burden of making buildings accessible. Those competing interests were taken into account when, close to 30 years ago, when the ADA was being considered and eventually passed in 1990. I don't have any problem with the standards that the law has established. I think they are they're objective and easy to understand. Older buildings have exemptions and don't have to comply with the same rules that new construction or remodeling has to. Personally and professionally, I'm of the opinion that every single access standard enshrined in law needs to be enforced. And the purpose of the law was to make the built-up environment accessible to people with disabilities, and landlords should be complying completely with governing laws.
And again, Thomas Gregory is Deputy Director of the Center for Independent Living. We could do a whole hour just on that, but I want to get more of your calls. Susan writes, in 2016, Congress decided that the departments of rehabilitation needed to focus more on blind and visually impaired youth, an admirable idea, but they did not fund the new mandate. As a result, the department was forced to scavenge from their own funds to pay for this change. The destruction of services to seniors has been devastating. It has also stripped funds from places like the Eaglebaum Center for the Blind in Santa Rosa, as well as the Lighthouse for the Blind in San Francisco. Let me go to more of your calls. And you can join us again by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Ruth Ann is joining us now by phone. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you very much for doing this show. I would like to comment that I'm very, very grateful. I use a wheelchair. I'm spinal cord injured. And whenever I go anywhere in public and just mention something that's not accessible, if I will point out to a store owner or a bus driver or what have you, the minute, and I don't threaten lawsuits, I just say, you know, this is illegal. I can't access ABC. They understand immediately. It's just so delightful. It's almost like pointing out to someone that it's illegal for first-degree murder. You don't have to explain that to someone. It's just totally a delight, and I think it's based on all the work that people before me did, Ed Roberts and those who followed him in passing the ADA, that made it such that it's common knowledge among all citizens in the world at large.
All right. I thank you for that, Ruth Ann. Good to hear from you.
And I thank you for the show.
Yeah, appreciate that as well. Thank you for calling. Let me get another caller on who wants to tell us a story. Michelle, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having the segment on Ops Day. I just wanted to speak a little bit on design and in terms of people's own perception of disability and just having a little empathy on what these people live through and simple things as not parking in disabled spots in a parking lot when, you know, you clearly aren't disabled or need the spot, I think is important. As well as designers, I have a design background. I just underscore at USC for landscape architecture. And I think that as designers plan the world and plan for the future of, you know, not knowing what's going to happen, I think that we really need to consider the most vulnerable of our population in design.
All right. I thank you for that. I appreciate hearing from you. Let me go back, if I may, to Zona Roberts, who is the mother of Ed Roberts and who's with us by phone this morning. Do you still hear, Zona Roberts, a lot of people giving tribute and honor to your son and the legacy that he's left?
I do indeed, Michael. And it's just one of the things I was thinking about, because Ed gets a lot of glory for a lot of things that other people did. I just saw a movie last night on Hale Zukas, who is just a cerebral palsy person. It's a wonderful movie. It'll be coming out pretty soon, done by the departments here. And that there are so many people working on, and Ed wasn't an only child. I had three other sons and a husband who was also very helpful for many years, as long as they were around. And Ed had a big mouth, and Ed liked publicity, which is very good for the whole movement, because he was not afraid to get out there and speak his mind after he learned that he wanted to live and he wanted to do things and he wanted to get around and be in the world in all its glory and all its faults. It's so many people, all family members and the politicians, when he first went to Washington, D.C. and met some of the Congress people, found he loved politicking, and he loved being out there. And I was so glad that he was able to do that. Well, brought a lot of people around.
I think a lot of people are glad as well. Let me bring some more of our callers on here. And again, Zona Roberts is mother of Ed Roberts. She's being honored this evening on what is Ed Roberts Day. And Oakland caller joins us. Belinda, hi.
Hi. I wanted to make people aware of a new law that's going into effect across the country. I worked at CIL, 20-plus years, and Ed Roberts always said, advocacy, advocacy, advocacy. So just wanted to let people know it's called the electronic visit verification requirement, and it's in the 21st Century Cures Act, and it attacks the heart of what enables many people with severe disabilities to live independently and stay out of institutions, and that's their relationship with their attendants, their personal care attendants. The elements in our government that feel like poor people are all criminals have now created a mandate that our attendants will have to use GPS on them and report what they're doing with working with a person with a disability in real time. And instead of to the person with a disability, in other words, it puts the state in between the person with a disability and those who work for us. And that's a very important relationship, because that's what keeps us out of institutions. And it's a very draconian measure that will also cause us to lose, I think, a whole generation of attendants, because people who work with us are not generally tech people, and they're already saying that they're not going to tolerate having GPS on them and us, because when they're with us, then we would also, both of us, be being monitored all the time. And it's a cruel new state, and it turns our homes into nursing homes, which is something that we always sort of fear, that the medical system in the state will take away the freedoms and control that we've developed over the years. And
Belinda, excuse me, but I think this goes back to something I mentioned before, AB 1335, which is trying to sort of circumnavigate against this. But I'm really grateful to you for bringing it to our attention, and I thank you for that. It is certainly important, and I'm sure a lot of these attendants don't necessarily have the experience with GPS, so thank you for that indeed. Here's Heidi, who says, I had the good fortune to be an intern at the World Institute on Disability with Ed Roberts in the mid-80s. I now have a son with cerebral palsy, and I'm working with parents of young adults with disabilities trying to build accessible, affordable housing in Santa Cruz. There's simply not enough public funding to meet the need. Property tax reform, waiving of permit fees, et cetera, would all make a difference in getting more housing built. And again, this is all part of this platform that I have to bring to the public's attention that's being put forward in terms of civil rights bills and bills about living for the disability, for those with disabilities of one sort or another. And let me go back to Corey Lee just for a moment before I take more of your calls, who's a travel writer and has done a lot of focus on traveling in a wheelchair. Corey Lee, what are the major concerns of, you've got a lot of people who follow you, What maintains or what continues to be their major concerns, particularly here in the Northern California area?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to traveling, really the number one question that I always get is about air travel.
Yeah.
And so how to fly as a wheelchair user. And, I mean, that's always my biggest concern as well whenever I'm traveling is, will my wheelchair actually, like, make it to the destination intact or will it be damaged? And then actually getting on the plane is a whole other process that's pretty difficult. So, I mean, stuff like that, and even just transportation in general. So whenever I travel to a city, really the first thing that I look at is the public transportation, like buses and the metro and things like that, accessible. And if they are, then it does make me want to go to that city more because I know that I'll be able to get around. So really, I mean, transportation seems to pretty consistently be the biggest barrier still.
Are there any places here in the Bay Area or in Northern California that particularly do it well from your perspective and cover the transportation area especially well?
Well, this is actually the first time that I've ever been in the Bay Area, and I just got here Saturday, so I can't really speak that well about Northern California. But so far in the San Francisco and Oakland area, I've had great success, and it's been fantastic.
Yeah, I think we're ahead of the learning curve in both those cities. And
yeah, definitely.
Most of the Bay Area. We may hear from some other people on that score. But let me bring a caller in from Emeryville, and that's Sarah, who's a disability access lawyer. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. The reason I called in was because previously a gentleman had called in about small businesses and the what he said were the onerous requirements of access. And I just wanted to explain that there is a difference between buildings that existed prior to the enactment of the ADA. If you have a building that was built before January 26, 1992, the standard is it readily achievable? And so basically a court would look at whether both the economics and sort of the logistics or the structure of the building to determine whether making it accessible were readily achievable. And then for new construction after January 26, 1992, that has to follow the standards. Unfortunately, sadly, I've been doing this litigation for many years, and sadly, there's still a lot of new construction, particularly well-funded new construction, that is done out of compliance with the standards.
Aren't there places protected for historical reasons, though? Even though,
yes.
Yeah, those.
That's also correct.
Past 1990, the date that you gave, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for that, and appreciate your calling in. Again, that's Sarah, who's a disability access lawyer, and we'll take another caller. We'll go to Berkeley and welcome Bert. Bert, you're on the air.
Hi, I went to the Center for Independent Living several times to get help with my dyslexia in college classes, and on the wall they had Henry Louis Mencken's picture because he has aphasia. Had aphasia. They had Albert Einstein and Whoopi Goldberg's pictures on the wall because they were both dyslexic. But I couldn't get any help at all. They were the only pictures on the wall of personalities that had handicaps. And then I got sent down to 6th Street where there's another educational program, and I couldn't get help from there. So a lot of time went by, and I was able to read the book about disability rights. I don't know the name of it exactly, but I was into the book a couple of chapters.
Bert, excuse me, I'm right up here on a break, but I think if I can go to the heart of your question and Thomas Gregory quickly on this, accessibility to the Center for Independent Living for those who have dyslexia or aphasia, are those under the rubric?
Well, I'm sorry if this gentleman didn't have a good or a productive experience at CIL. We're not experts in dyslexia or learning disabilities generally, but we are experts in information and referral. So I don't know exactly what this gentleman's goal was with respect to overcoming any problems that were related to his dyslexia. But hopefully, we will able to provide him with some useful information and referral. He mentioned being referred to a building on 6th Street. Perhaps we made that referral. I am hearing that it wasn't a very fruitful referral. So I regret that we weren't able to help this person with the particular goal he was pursuing.
Well, let me thank him for the call and remind you you're listening to Forum, and we're talking with a number of people about disabilities, Thomas Gregory, Deputy Director of the Center for Independent Living, Raymond Lifshitz, who is Professor of Architecture at UC Berkeley, and Corey Lee, a travel writer who has a blog for the disabled. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support this radio station, go to kqed.org. And we'll go to more of your phone calls. Let me go next to Santa Cruz and welcome Michelle. Michelle, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to say thank you to Cecil, Center for Independent Living, for being there for my brother, who is a survivor of a traumatic brain injury from a car accident. He was in a coma for 9 months, and he actually is not in a wheelchair, believe it or not. And you guys, as far as putting that all into place around the country, it makes such a difference for people with, you know, limited functioning, any person who needs it, basically. I'm so glad you guys are there, and I just wanted to say thank you.
Well, good of you to call, and I'm sure Thomas Gregory appreciates that. And let me actually detail.
We very much do. Yeah.
With a question for you from a listener, Thomas. Beth wants to know about the landscape for web and app accessibility, and particularly for the hearing and sight impaired. Is this the next frontier?
Yes. With the proliferation of, you know, electronic communications, I think web accessibility is very much going to be at the forefront of accessibility efforts in the near future. It's already started. I believe a section of I'm pretty ignorant about the exact sections, but I believe there's a section 508 of the ADA that addresses website accessibility. Certainly all government entities and I believe private businesses too are going to need to make their websites screen readable so that folks with folks who are blind and use screen reading software can get all the same content from the website that someone with vision could. So yes, I do think electronic accessibility is very very relevant today.
Here's another caller joining us. Doug, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to acknowledge the power of what Ed did and all the other people who worked with him. My father had a spinal cord injury that changed our lives pretty significantly. The 14 years that he was alive really changed how we interacted with hotels and airports and restaurants and where I chose to live. I always made sure there was an elevator, all of those things. And I think that just really opened up our lives to how an entire segment of the population lived that we were just unaware of. And it made us much more engaged with the disabled community and what we can do to help. And so I just wanted to thank Ed and all of his all of his compadres that that have made our lives a lot easier. And
you can thank his mother. She's still with us. She gave birth to him.
Well, it goes to everybody. You know, it provided a new opportunity. There's an organization called Environmental Traveling Companions that I became very involved in. And we took my father for a sea kayaking journey in San Francisco Bay after he was already injured. And he felt weightless and out on the water. And I just encourage anybody out there listening to look us up. We're based in Fort Mason, San Francisco, so Environmental Traveling Companions. So thank you to everybody.
All right. Thank you, Doug, for the call. Good to hear from you and from all those we heard from this hour. And I want to extend thanks to our guests. Again, congratulations to Zona Roberts, mother of Ed Roberts, who is with us, and Raymond Lifshitz, who is professor of architecture and city and regional planning at UC Berkeley, and Corey Lee, a travel writer who focuses on traveling in a wheelchair. They are all receiving awards this evening at UC Berkeley. This being Ed Roberts Day, I also want to thank Thomas Gregory, who joined us as well, Deputy Director of the Center for Independent Living, and Lowell Bergman, Professor of Investigative Reporting at UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. We're looking at a comment here from Anthony, who says, as Santa Rosa and Sonoma County rebuild after the fire, new housing should have basic accessibility. We're going to talk about new housing, and we're going to talk about Coffee Park specifically in the hour ahead as we continue to look at rebuilding after the terrible fires up north. Thank you for joining us for this hour, and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.